2. The Meeting with the Goddess. The ultimate adventure, when all the barriers and ogres have been overcome, is commonly represented as a mystical marriage of the triumphant hero soul with the queen goddess of the world. This is the crisis at the nadir, at the zenith, or at the uttermost edge of the earth, at the central point of the cosmos. In the tabernacle of the temple, or within the darkness of the deepest chamber of the heart. In the west of Ireland, they still tell the tale of the Prince of the Lonesome Isle and the Lady of Tubber Tin Tai. Hoping to heal the Queen of Erin, the heroic youth had undertaken to go for 3 bottles of the water of Tubber Tin Tai, the flaming fairy well. Following the advice of a supernatural aunt, whom he encountered on the way, and riding a wonderful, dirty, lean little shaggy horse that she gave to him, he crossed a river of fire and escaped the touch of a grove of poison trees. The horse, with the speed of the wind, shot past the end of the castle of Tubber Tin Tai. The prince sprang from its back through an open window and came down inside, safe and sound.
The whole place, enormous in extent, was filled with sleeping giants and monsters of sea and land, great whales, long slippery eels, bears, and beasts of every form and kind. The prince passed through them and over them till he came to a great stairway. At the head of the stairway, he went into a chamber where he found the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, stretched on a couch, asleep. "I'll have nothing to say to you," thought he, and went on to the next. And so he looked into 12 chambers. In each was a woman more beautiful than the one before. But when he reached the 13th chamber and opened the door, the flash of gold took the sight from his eyes. He stood a while till the sight came back, and then entered. In the great bright chamber was a golden couch resting on wheels of gold. The wheels turned continually. The couch went round and round, never stopping night or day. On the couch lay the Queen of Tubber Tin Tai. And if her 12 maidens were beautiful, they would not be beautiful if seen near her. At the foot of the couch was Tubber Tin Tai itself, the Well of Fire. There was a golden cover upon the well, and it went around continually with the couch of the queen. "Upon my word," said the prince, "I'll rest here a while." And he went up on the couch and never left it for 6 days and nights.
The Lady of the House of Sleep is a familiar figure in fairy tale and myth. We have already spoken of her under the forms of Brunhild and Little Briar Rose. She is the paragon of all paragons of beauty, the reply to all desire, the bliss-bestowing goal of every hero's earthly and unearthly quest. She is mother, sister, mistress, bride. Whatever in the world has lured, whatever has seemed to promise joy, has been premonitory of her existence, in the deep of sleep, if not in the cities and forests of the world. For she is the incarnation of the promise of perfection, the soul's assurance that, at the conclusion of its exile in a world of organized inadequacies, the bliss that once was known will be known again. The comforting, the nourishing, the good mother, young and beautiful, who was known to us and even tasted in the remotest past. Time sealed her away, yet she is dwelling still, like one who sleeps in timelessness at the bottom of the timeless sea. The remembered image is not only benign, however, for the bad mother too, one, the absent, unattainable mother, against whom aggressive fantasies are directed, and from whom a counteraggression is feared. 2. The hampering, forbidding, punishing mother. 3. the mother who would hold to herself the growing child trying to push away, and finally, 4, the desired but forbidden mother, Oedipus complex, whose presence is a lure to dangerous desire, castration complex, persists in the hidden land of the adult's infant recollection and is sometimes even the greater force. She is at the root of such unattainable great goddess figures as that of the chaste and terrible Diana, whose absolute ruin of the young sportsman Actaeon illustrates what a blast of fear is contained in such symbols of the mind's and body's blocked desire. Actaeon chanced to see the dangerous goddess at noon. That fateful moment when the sun breaks in its youthful, strong ascent, balances, and begins the mighty plunge to death. He had left his companions to rest, together with his blooded dogs, after a morning of running game, and without conscious purpose had gone wandering, straying from his familiar hunting groves and fields, exploring through the neighboring woods. He discovered a vale, thick grown with cypresses and pine. He penetrated curiously into its fastness. There was a grotto within it, watered by a gentle, purling spring, and with a stream that widened to a grassy pool. This shaded nook was the resort of Diana, and at that moment she was bathing among her nymphs, absolutely naked. She had put aside her hunting spear, her quiver, her unstrung bow, as well as her sandals and her robe. And one of the nude nymphs had bound up her tresses into a knot. Some of the others were pouring water from capacious urns. When the young, roving male broke into the pleasant haunt, a shriek of female terror went up, and all the bodies crowded about their mistress, trying to hide her from the profane eye. But she stood above them, head and shoulders. The youth had seen and was continuing to see. She glanced for her bow, but it was out of reach. So she quickly took up what was at hand, namely water, and flung it into Actaeon's face. "Now you are free to tell, if you can," she cried at him angrily, "that you have seen the goddess nude." Antlers sprouted on his head. His neck grew great and long, his ear tips sharp. His arms lengthened to legs, and his hands and feet became hooves. Terrified, he bounded, marveling that he should move so rapidly. But when he paused for breath and drink and beheld his features in a clear pool, he reared back aghast. A terrible fate then befell Actaeon. His own hounds, catching the scent of the great stag, came baying through the wood. In a moment of joy at hearing them, he paused, but then spontaneously took fright and fled. The pack followed, gradually gaining. When they had come to his heels, the first of them flying at his flank, he tried to cry their names. But the sound in his throat was not human. They fixed him with their fangs. He went down, and his own hunting companions, shouting encouragement at the dogs, arrived in time to deliver the coup de grace. Diana, miraculously aware of the flight and death, could now rest appeased. The mythological figure of the universal mother imputes to the cosmos the feminine attributes of the first nourishing and protecting presence. The fantasy is primarily spontaneous, for there exists a close and obvious correspondence between the attitude of the young child toward its mother and that of the adult toward the surrounding material world. But there has been also, in numerous religious traditions, a consciously controlled pedagogical utilization of this archetypal image for the purpose of the purging, balancing, and initiation of the mind into the nature of the visible world. In the tantric books of medieval and modern India, the abode of the goddess is called Mani Dvipa, the island of jewels. Her couch and throne is there, in a grove of wish-fulfilling trees. The beaches of the isle are of golden sands. They are laved by the still waters of the ocean of the nectar of immortality. The goddess is red with the fire of life. The earth, the solar system, the galaxies of far-extending space all swell within her womb. For she is the world creatrix, ever mother, ever virgin. She encompasses the encompassing, nourishes the nourishing, and is the life of everything that lives. She is also the death of everything that dies. The whole round of existence is accomplished within her sway, from birth through adolescence, maturity, and senescence to the grave. She is the womb and the tomb, the sow that eats her farrow. Thus she unites the good and the bad, exhibiting the two modes of the remembered mother, not as personal only, but as universal. The devotee is expected to contemplate the two with equal equanimity. Through this exercise, his spirit is purged of its infantile, inappropriate sentimentalities and resentments, and his mind opened to the inscrutable presence which exists not primarily as good and bad with respect to his childlike human convenience, his weal and woe, but as the law and image of the nature of being.
The sacred writings, shastras, of Hinduism are divided into four classes. 1. Shruti, which are regarded as direct divine revelation. These include the four Vedas, ancient books of Psalms, and certain of the Upanishads, ancient books of philosophy. 2. Smriti, which include the traditional teachings of the orthodox sages, canonical instructions for domestic ceremonials, and certain works of secular and religious law, as well as the great Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, which of course includes the Bhagavad Gita. 3. Purana, which are the Hindu mythological and epic works par excellence. These treat of cosmogonic, theological, astronomical, and physical knowledge. And 4. Tantra, texts describing techniques and rituals for the worship of deities, and for the attainment of supranormal power. Among the tantras are a group of particularly important scriptures, called Agamas, which are supposed to have been revealed directly by the universal god Shiva and his goddess, Parvati. They are termed, therefore, the fifth Veda. These support a mystical tradition known specifically as the Tantra, which has exercised a pervasive influence on the later forms of Hindu and Buddhist iconography. Tantric symbolism was carried by medieval Buddhism out of India into Tibet, China, and Japan.
The great Hindu mystic of the 19th century, Ramakrishna, 1836 to 1886, was a priest in a temple newly erected to the Cosmic Mother at Dakshineswar, a suburb of Calcutta. The temple image displayed the divinity in her two aspects simultaneously, the terrible and the benign. Her four arms exhibited the symbols of her universal power, the upper left hand brandishing a bloody saber, the lower gripping by the hair a severed human head. The upper right was lifted in the fear not gesture, the lower extended in bestowal of boons. As necklace, she wore a garland of human heads. Her kilt was a girdle of human arms. Her long tongue was out to lick blood.